You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the podcast network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, September 9th, 2009. This is episode 96, Failure for Free. Time again for the Wells Tech Podcast. We're up to episode 96, and joining me, as always, is Sally Draper. Good morning, Sally.
Hi, Martin. I'm coming off a Labor Day weekend, all refreshed and ready to talk tech and ministry. How about you?
I'm always ready to talk tech and ministry, weekend or no.
Okay.
And that's what we're going to do, and we should probably jump right into the topic. We've got a bunch of stuff that we want to talk through on the show, but we had the idea of working through a book from Clay Shirky. Probably, I don't know when we started this whole thing, probably almost a year ago, I would suspect.
Yeah,
we're up to chapter 10 of his book, Here Comes Everybody, and maybe just a little bit of the backstory. Sally and I both came across this, and I think almost independently, probably from recommendations from others. It's a book about new media. Clay Shirky is a writer and a teacher. I think he's at NYU, New York University, in their interactive telecommunications program. Very smart guy. I've read some of his other stuff as well. He's constantly referenced in the tech industry as kind of being a forward thinker and a very analytical thinker about how technology is impacting society. And this book, Here Comes Everybody, really focuses on new media and social networks and how they have had an impact on society. And as Sally and I got to talking about it and did our own reading, we thought, hey, this would be a great topic to talk through on the Wells Tech Podcast, because it does have impact on ministry. And some of the tools that he talks about do have impact on ministry. So hopefully those of you that have been following along at home have recognized some ministry applications to some of the thoughts that are coming out. And Chapter 10 is no different. It's called Failure for Free. And there were all kinds of things that popped into my head as I was rereading this for the show today about application for ministry. Maybe, Sally, we should talk about what the general theme of the chapter is, Failure for Free.
And I guess, Martin, I felt like it kind of revisited a theme that we've looked at in the past and focused a lot on what's called the power law distribution, which is the success of a very few and a long tail of very minor instances. Mm-hmm. For most of the majority of people, I'd say, 95% of people participating in an activity, for instance, aren't going to have the widespread acclaim that a very few 5% or less are going to reach in that particular activity. And Clay talked about that earlier in the book and demonstrated it with, various technology examples, things like the number of contributors to Wikipedia, and the fact that there's this small group of people that contribute just volumes to Wikipedia versus this huge quantity of people that contribute one or two things max.
And are just really consumers of the content, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So this chapter kind of looked at that power law distribution in terms of failure, I guess is one way to look at it. And in terms of the fact that it's very low cost to try things in this digital age, let's say you want to have a wiki about a particular topic. Well, how many people go and create wikis each day on either WebPaint or Wikispaces or PBWorks or whatever wiki tool that's out there? And how many of them actually follow it through to fruition and make it a viable website that has longstanding meaning and content updates and things like that? Mm-hmm. So again, it doesn't cost anything for me to go to WebPaint and create that wiki, and I may forget about it within the hour,
right,
or within the day or within the week or whatever. But it's definitely a low cost, free entry level there, and I think he spent a lot of time in this chapter talking specifically about the open source software movement and how things like Linux developed, and again, with very large number of contributors that just give one or two things to the Linux development code, but just a few people that actually do the core work of the system. So interesting kind of a economic lesson almost in that power law distribution.
As I was reading this chapter, one thing that came to my mind was our podcast, where we had no idea how this would go and if anybody would ever listen, or whether we'd just be talking to each other and just having something recorded while we did it. And it fits nicely into this concept of failure for free, a very low cost to start up. We're using free tools. And at the very beginning, we were using all open source products like Audacity, and we were using Skype and just basically our plain old computers. We didn't have much for microphones or anything like that, and it's kind of evolved since then. And it still doesn't cost much to do the show. But and if we failed, you know, we got 5 shows in or 10 shows in and nobody was listening, then, you know, we would just stop doing it. And that's kind of the concept here, where he goes through some very successful startups like Linux, for instance, and how that was one person's idea. And it was interesting to read Linus Torvalds' first post on a discussion board saying, I'm thinking about this new operating system. If you got any ideas, send them my way. Can't promise I'll implement them. I don't know if this will go anywhere, but, you know, it's kind of a hobby thing.
Yeah, I love that word, hobby. Yeah. Linux was a hobby.
Right, and very low startup costs, and it just created a lot of interest over time and is now one of the operating systems that essentially runs the Internet. A lot of websites, in fact, I could probably say a majority of them, run on Linux systems. A lot of the software that runs on top of Linux, like Apache, those kinds of things, run all the websites, or many of the websites of the Internet. So low cost to start up. So I think the first ministry application that came to mind as I read through that portion of this chapter 10 was try it. You know, try stuff, especially in the technology age. And we talk a lot about those kinds of things on the show, Sally. There's no harm in trying stuff. And congregations can do it at a very low cost. And if that doesn't mean you don't put any planning or energy into the success of a program. But whether you're talking about online Bible studies or I put a whole list together here. Let me see if I can find my list now. Anything to do with outreach. So a website in general, very low cost to start up, any of your promotional stuff, an intranet, training classes, online giving, email, affinity groups, online Bible study. All those things can be done digitally with very low cost to start up. And if they fail, they fail. And then you try the next thing.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of made some notes myself, Martin, along those lines that, you know, we're not here to judge the success or failure of gospel outreach. Mm-hmm. God says just to put the word out there and, you know, and let it work on the hearts that hear it, that kind of thing. But we do have limited resources. I mean, there's only so much time in the day, so many keys that my little fingers can peck on to to crank out different digital content in whatever format that is. So we want to use it in the best way possible. But I guess, you know, that whole concept of failure for free, you know, if you reach one lost soul, I wouldn't consider that a failure. It's okay to be in that long tail and just be doing, you know, your thing and reaching out in your way. And I think you can consider any of those outreach efforts a success. I kind of, instead of targeting particular ministries like what you were listing, I just was thinking about key congregational committees that should really consider doing something, like your outreach committee, maybe if you have a communication committee or a technology committee. Those would be good areas to just kind of say, you know, we've got this tool set available to us. We can try things for free. Let's see where that takes us, and maybe build in some planning, like having a technology plan in place that makes use of all these different digital avenues. But whatever your plans are, do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get moving, give it a try. Gauge how your time and energy and efforts. Reach out to people and try some different things if you aren't seeing any response from them.
Yeah, an important takeaway for congregations and schools, for that matter, is just the whole creative process. Spend some time thinking, spend some time brainstorming about all the possibilities that are out there. It doesn't mean you have to do any of them. But I think it's important just to intentionalize the creative process in whatever setting, especially in the area of technology, as new things are coming and as your audiences are diving into some of those areas, whether you're finding people on Twitter or Facebook or email or website surfers or whatever it is, it makes sense to say, hey, what about? You know, just ask that question, what about this? What about that? And again, the neat part about some of the things that we get to talk about, Sally, is, again, it's free to try. If you are unsuccessful in your, let's call it a Twitter ministry, what have you really lost other than time? And a point that Clay makes is that some of the best things that are now on the internet, the most successful things that are now on the internet, came out of failed attempts previous or prior to that. So you learn from those failures, say, hey, this didn't work. You ask yourself why, and then you go into that, you know, that next brainstorming session saying, well, that didn't work, but, you know, what about this? And it doesn't take much to really find something that would be of benefit to your ministry.
And, you know, Martin, kind of circling back to the whole Wells Tech experience, for me personally, you know, the key to the success of the show has been the community feedback, mm-hmm. and the sharing, you know, that we've been able to afford. And again, you've got that long tail feature there as well, because sometimes you just hear from someone just one time, but their idea is just so awesome. And it really can have an impact on what you're doing, making you think about trying something different or going at it at a different angle or whatever. And so I think, you know, there's power in that. And that's something that, you know, even we as a synod couldn't force people into doing that kind of thing, or draw out all of those great ideas, you know, from that one person at that one moment or whatever. But that whole shared community thing has allowed that to happen.
Yep. And a very nice segue into a contest that we're running for our 100th anniversary show is we'd love to hear some of the ideas that have surfaced on this show and how you've used them and how they've had some impact on what you do in your church or school. Sally, give us some of the details for the contest.
Well, coming up on October 7th is our big 100th anniversary, and we're dedicating the show to our listeners. We're calling it Wells Tech and You, and what we'd like to do is have all our listeners just send in an idea or two that has had some positive impact in their ministry, and they can do that through any of our various communication channels. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook. You can send us an email directly at wellstech@wells.net, or leave us a comment even on our show notes website, which is wellstech.wells.net. However you can get us the information, we'd love to hear from you, and we'd like to compile a lot of these stories from our listeners about the impact that the show has had on their ministry. I personally can think of a lot mm-hmm. to contribute in that way, because we're just doing things a lot differently here at St. John's since we started the Wells Tech podcast, and just learning all these different ideas from different listeners and things. If you send us a contribution, we'll enter you in a drawing. We're giving away a really nice SIG water bottle. I read about it. I don't have the specs in front of me, but it's like made of aluminum or something, mm-hmm. and really stylish, and of course featuring that great Wells Tech podcast logo right there on the front of the water bottle.
Who wouldn't want that? Yes,
that's right. You got to have one.
I wish I actually had one. So, but you and I cannot enter.
No,
even though we've used many of the ideas ourselves.
That's right. We just get to benefit from it all.
That's right. So please keep that in mind. You have from now until, did we say a deadline? You know, probably you'll announce that of the show before the 100th. So get your entries in. We would love to feature, basically have the whole show talking about some of the great things that are happening out there based on conversations we've had with you, the listener, on the Wells Tech podcast.
I think another angle of that, Martin, has been the great interviews that we've had and the things we've learned from those interviews. And today is no exception.
That's
we have a interview with someone who's doing fantastic things with MIDI in the worship setting. So music for your worship, if you don't have people gifted in playing organ or whatever instrument that you can incorporate into your worship.
So, yeah, we sat down with Danny Wehmeyer from Florida, a dedicated layman who has done some wonderful work with MIDI, as Sally mentioned. So let's listen to our conversation with Danny and how he has some wonderful resources that may be available to you and your church. Joining us today from New Smyrna Beach, Florida, no envy in my voice at all there, Danny, is Danny Wehmeyer, layman and very active in a lot of synod activity. We're going to talk a little bit today about his heart for and involvement in MIDI technology. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, Martin. Good morning, Sally.
Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate you taking the time. You told us in our pre-show conversation you just got back from a nice walk on the beach at the sunrise out there. So is New Smyrna Beach on the Gulf side or the Atlantic side?
The Atlantic side.
Okay. Beautiful.
We're just south of Daytona and about 40 miles north of the Cape. So we get to go down and watch the shuttle launches.
Oh, wonderful. Wow, that must be neat, huh?
It's incredible.
And so maybe we should start the interview just letting you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. What position do you hold there in your congregation? And I know you've held some synodical positions and still do. So let us know a little bit about who Danny Wehmeyer is.
Well, currently I'm a member of Good Shepherd in Deltona, Florida. I've been there a couple of years, and now I'm serving on just on the Constitution Committee. Previous congregations, I've held most of the different congregational offices. Mm-hmm. At the Senate level, I'm currently serve on the Board for World Missions, where I'm the vice chairman. And I just finished up a couple year term on the, or a couple year assignment on the Ad Hoc Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Previous to that, I served on the South Atlantic District Mission Board from 87 to 2004.
Right. That's where we got to know each other a little bit.
Yes.
That was down in South Carolina. Right. So does your work on the World Mission Board take you to different foreign countries then, overseas or wherever?
Yes. I was in Africa in February visiting Zambia and Malawi for a couple weeks. Last year I went to India for a couple weeks. Incredible. And then previous times I've been to Southeast Asia, you know, Hong Kong, China, Indonesia, Papua.
Oh, neat. Maybe if we have time later, we can maybe talk about some of the technologies or lack thereof, you know, in some of those, in sort of those foreign mission fields. I'm sure it's all over the board there. So.
Yes, it is.
So primarily we wanted to talk to you about MIDI technology, your involvement in something called the MIDI Music Project, or something that you've spent a lot of time with, was of interest to us. And I know we get, Sally and I get questions on it on a fairly regular basis, as a lot of congregations are, if it's not their primary source of congregational music or special music, it's definitely becoming an element in a lot of different congregations. So what got you interested in MIDI technology in the first place?
Well, as I said, I started on the mission board back in 87. And as I visited the congregation I was in had an organ, we had musicians. It was never an element in my own congregation back in the early years. But as I visited other mission congregations, I would see, you know, a lot of them struggling with music on Sunday morning. And it just dawned on me that there's got to be a better way to do this. And then somewhere, I lose track of the dates. I remember a pastor in South Florida started playing with MIDI and started putting some of the hymnal stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just, I had downloaded some MIDI files off the internet back in the early days, and I listened to them on the little built-in MIDI in my computer, and I got interested, and then I realized with the piece of software called Cakewalk, you could actually edit these and do things with them. And I started saying, wow, we've got potential here. And it just kind of evolved from that.
Now, when you say some of these congregations were struggling with music, you meant mostly because of the lack of, especially in mission congregations, a lack of musicians and people that could be counted on Sunday over Sunday?
Yes, it was a combination of lack of people to play or even decent instruments to play. Yeah, but mostly it was lack of a musician that just struggled to put something together. I remember being in a small church in Florida. They're no longer there, so but I won't mention the name. And the young girl started to play the song, and it was just so bad. The pastor, just after about halfway through the first verse, said, "Could we just start over on that one?"
This is a do-over. Yeah,
it was a do-over. I felt so bad for her because I mean she was trying
hard.
So far over her head.
Yeah.
And we did make it through. And I've been to church services. We sang a cappella because we had nothing. I joined the Wells. The church I joined, I know at one time, they used an old big, big reel-to-reel recorder, you know, and George would sit in the back and start and stop, you know, the music. So it's come a long way.
Yep.
You know, I came from a mission setting in Texas. We were at Atonement in Plano for a period of time. As a matter of fact, that's where my husband and I got married. And we used a MIDI organ there. I did a little bit of Cakewalk programming myself, trying to put together MIDI files to be played. Because back in the day, there wasn't a whole lot of resources available. Do you have any good stories to share with us, like what it's allowed congregations to do, where you've seen success with congregations using MIDI?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I've seen success in a lot of missions where they've taken it. MIDI requires two things. It requires some technical skill. It requires some musical skills. And what happens a lot of times is somebody's one or the other. They're a musician, have no idea how to use the Cakewalk or program it correctly or whatever. Or they have great technical skills, but no musical ability. And I want to tell you the funny one, then I'll get to some of the good stories. I was at an installation service in the South Atlantic District several years ago, and the previous pastor who was there had MIDI. He had the files and stuff, and he used a Casio keyboard. Well, the new pastor come in, and they went out and bought a Yamaha keyboard, and the music that they had, the MIDI files, were programmed for the Casio to play the organ notes on the Casio.
I can see where this is going already.
Yeah, they just run these through their Yamaha with the general MIDI, and it just happened to translate the four parts that had been programmed in for different organ parts on the Casio, played four varieties of saxophone.
Oh,
it was things like they just knew something was wrong but didn't understand what. And I'm sitting there through this whole installation service, four part saxophone.
That would have played well in New Orleans.
Well, this was towards New Orleans, but not quite that far over.
Okay.
But since then, I've seen congregations take this and they go from just the basic being able to play their hymns and their psalms and the liturgies and so forth, to having like beautiful supplemental music, adding for festival Sundays, being to add, you know, a lot of different parts and variety, instrumentals that can be played during communion or the offering, supporting the choir. Now what I found that people more and more are getting into where they understand the MIDI part are being able to use it, but they still don't quite understand their audio. And so many churches, being good Wells Lutherans and cheap, you know, we go out, buy a set of speakers, hang them on the wall, like, okay, got it.
Mm-hmm.
Saved a lot of money. The speaker placement is horrible. They don't have subwoofers. There's no bass to the music. So they're learning to, like, okay, spend a few bucks, go to your local music store, a guy who sets up church music, let him come out, you know, look at your congregation, look at your sanctuary, understand how to put the speakers and so forth, so you get good sound from your MIDI and even from your microphone.
I suppose one of the goals would be to make it not sound like MIDI, to make it sound as natural as possible.
Yes. MIDI, most of the MIDI that we have access to was actually programmed in from a computer keyboard. It was programmed in a quarter note is a quarter note, a half a note is a half a note, an eighth note is an eighth note. The problem with that is it's very wooden.
Mm-hmm.
An organ hides it a little bit. It's not quite as noticeable. But if you use piano, It's, I always tell people, to me, it's like somebody beating a spoon on a tin roof. It's just horrible. There are ways to humanize the music. I have software that will humanize it, and it works really good with organ. I still have not found a way on piano where I'm happy with anything that's been programmed in on the computer that sounds right. Somebody had to actually play it on a and capture it from a MIDI keyboard that could play it live and then capture it as MIDI and play it back for it to me for it to sound good. But for organ, I think the technology is, I'm very pleased with it.
So that would be one way I think that it can be done well and kind of avoid the obvious mechanical nature of it. Are there other tricks, other considerations when you're putting together MIDI music and trying to incorporate that into a worship setting?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is again, if your whole system sounds good, if you have MIDI files that have at least been a little humanized to help a little bit, and then the selection of your instrument.
Right, the
A lot of
voices,
it's
right.
in little mission congregations, they want to play these big full rank organ sounds. Now, that's great in a cathedral, but that's horrible. It's hard to sing to. You need just a couple of different ranks to carry the tune and give you a little enhancement there to sound good. And then at Easter, you open up the ranks. Christmas, you open up the ranks. On the fifth verse, you open up the ranks, and you really belt it out. But for normal singing, I think people want to do a little too much, or they want to play. They want to have about six different instruments going, and it can be done well, but usually it just confuses the people trying to sing. And the whole purpose of the music really isn't to be the showpiece, it's to get people to sing. When our Lutherans sing well, it is incredible.
Right. Now back in the, go ahead, Sally, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, can you tell us how you might get started with that? What kind of software resources, if somebody were just getting started today, would be necessary to do MIDI well?
Well, there are a lot of first thing you need is a sequencer, something that will actually play the MIDI. I mean, there's built-in stuff in your computer that will just play it, but you have no control over the tempo or anything else. It'll just sequence it and play it. I recommend a piece of software called Cakewalk. And Cakewalk, I started back at version 3, and the one I use now is equivalent to about version 18, I think, over many years. But actually, a version called Cakewalk Home Studio 2002 is still my favorite that I like. Works on anything from 98, Windows 98 and up. And so you need that, and then you can actually see it there. You have the ability to change your instruments. If you want a different kind of organ or you want to add a flute part or something in there, that's all available right on screen to easily do. You can jump if you want to skip verses and things. There's ways to do that. And because we have a lot of chanted music in some of our older liturgies and all the songs, there's a chant where you have to actually advance the tone. And something like Cakewalk, we put markers in there that allow you to just jump ahead at the right time just by clicking the mouse or a keystroke sequence that allows you to do that. So you need the software, and then of course you need something to play it back through. You need a synthesizer of some sort. I happen to use an Alesis. Some people use a Roland, Yamaha. The brand doesn't matter. What matters is you buy something that you like the sound of. And now congregations are even starting to find software sequencers that are quite good, that just if you have a good enough computer, you don't even need the separate piece of hardware. You can come right out of the back of your sound card with all that sound without having an additional piece of hardware there to translate the MIDI into music. I guess maybe at the front end we should have said MIDI is not music. It's kind of like electronic roll on a player piano. You actually need something to get the sound out of, and that's what the synthesizer does. So those are the main things you need. If you have an external box, you also need an interface of some sort, like to get from a USB port to the MIDI ports, or it might be a box that does that. You need something in between. But a little sequencer that costs about $100 and a synthesizer anywhere from a few hundred to a few $1,000, you can hook these things up to large pipe organs. A lot of those have MIDI interfaces on them now.
Right. Suppose we should have defined MIDI before we even started. It stands for Musical Instrument Digital Interface. So it's really the ability to make music via ones and zeros, essentially. So
yes.
So what I suppose congregations don't have to start from scratch now. Like, I know when I was in South Carolina, we basically plugged in every single hymn, every single piece of liturgy laboriously, before the Sunday service. I assume most of that has been done for Christian worship and other things that we might be able to use. Are there resources out there that congregations can grab onto or purchase?
There are multiple sources to do that. I have all the music from Christian worship in MIDI format that is available, has been paid for. I just ask that people work through their, don't just everybody call me and say, hey, Danny, I want to copy that. They really need to work through the mission boards because I don't know who should get it and who shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have that available. And if people tell me what kind of sequencer they have, then it can be customized so that when it comes out right off the CD and they play it, it works for the type of music that they want. Like they said, okay, here's my instrument and here's the voices that I like, then I would send it to them for that particular instrument. And they wouldn't have to go back on every song and reprogram them. Once they had it, they could reprogram if they wanted to change it.
Right.
But it would work out of the box. I have software that will just kind of go through and take the whole package and convert it. It takes about an hour on my part to do that, but that's better than somebody individually having to go in and change 700 pieces.
What a wonderful resource that's got to be.
Yeah, and a lot of shareware that I bought from a programmer in Austria, a couple of them in Ukraine, one in Germany. I mean, just different places that make this software that lets me do these different things. That's available. Of course, HymnSoft is available from the publishing house. They're coming out with a new version that will have the supplement. I don't have any supplemental music.
Mm-hmm.
I just have the licensed version of what's in Christian worship. And maybe a quick note on copyrights. Our churches are really bad about ignoring copyrights. And that's why you haven't seen this as widespread, because I have a process people have to go through to get this legally. It's just signing papers and said, hey, you're responsible and you won't share this, and because I'm the one that goes to jail if it's misused.
Yeah, that would not be a good thing. Your wife would not really enjoy that part of it.
No, that's held up the distribution somewhat. But anyway, they're there, and there's the music from South Florida got sent around the world. So a lot of people use those original MIDI files. Because different people sent those out to people, ignored the copyrights. So a lot of people are using those uncopyrighted versions. And shoot, if you want to use what you got, fine. Just contact me, and I'll make you legal. Even if you use, I don't care which particular MIDI file you use, I will just give you the legal means of using the music in Christian worship.
Right.
And I also, Martin, now have MP3 files. Legally, I can't do full like CD wave files, but I have MP3 files. I can't obviously do the chanted music, the psalms, and some of the older things, because there's no way to advance that on MP3. And because I started with my MIDI file won't let me, like, while I'm capturing it, the audio, I can't like jump it while I do that.
Right. But so MP3 is what they allow a congregation basically to play it on any. And basically any computer hooked up to the audio system.
Oh, it wouldn't even have to be a computer. They could play it from their iPod.
All right. That's right.
Literally, you could play it from your iPod. So I have those available as well.
And I think that's useful in terms of taking worship out to different worship settings. Like my husband does a nursing home devotion each week, and using the MP3s is a real powerful thing for that.
Yeah,
right. I have several of our mission pastors. They have like where they go on campus or youth groups or if it's to a nursing home or whatever, have said yes. The MP3 files have been very beneficial for that.
That's sweet. Very nice. So you have all the hymns in MP3, or just those that don't have copyright implications?
So I have all the hymns.
Okay.
I said the copyright that I got enabled me to do basically MIDI, MP3, Windows MW, what is it?
WMV, right.
MV. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the video format
Or
of
WMA. WMA, right.
WMA. Thank you. It's like nobody uses it anymore, but I just cannot do the full way because some of this music is sold as CDs, and that would conflict. So,
Right.
and a lot of these copyright, I convinced them to give me for free. We still have to honor them, but I didn't have to. Some of them I had to actually pay retail, and a lot of them, because we put a couple of caveats on, we were able to get free and save a whole lot of money.
So just to make sure I understand correctly, is this just for mission congregations, or is it for any Wells congregation that they could request this?
It's meant for mission congregations. Sometimes I am loose in the terms of mission. If you're out there doing mission work, I'm not going to hold whether or not you're getting subsidy from the DMV or not. But what I don't want to say is, because I have a limited number of these, I can't say, okay, all the 1,200 congregation in Wells call me, because it would totally overwhelm me anyway. Do that. That's why I said, if you want this, you contact your mission board. They can go through Home Missions and get to me to say, yes, it's okay for you to have that. If the mission board says a congregation should have it, that's all I need to know.
All right, sweet. Boy, what a blessing that is, I'm sure, to many congregations. So hopefully they can take advantage of that. Danny, thanks so much for your time. This is a wonderful resource, and I think that as the use of technology in worship grows, I'm sure you'll be staying on top of that as well. But this is really, I'm sure, helpful to both big and small congregations alike.
It's a good thing. My last congregation, we did it for about 3 years. We had a period that we didn't have full-time musicians, and we used it full-time, well, at least three-fourths of the time for about 3 years. And it was a real blessing to do, and it was a fun thing
Yep,
to do.
wonderful. Danny, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your work here in Medi Technology, and thanks for everything you do for the Synod. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Martin. Thank you, Tom.
Again, thanks to Danny for spending some time with us. Very envious of Danny's nice little walk on the beach to see the sunrise this morning. I saw the sunrise, but it was out my bathroom window, and I suppose we can't complain. Yeah, we have had wonderful weather the last week and a half here at in Wisconsin. I suppose you've had some of that too, Sally, but it's not the same. It's not the
No, no
same.
beach setting. Although we do have Lake Sleepy Eye, we can go walk around the lake.
Okay.
Not quite the same, but I am excited about Danny's sharing that information with us. Martin, last week we played an interview with three guys from the SIM class of 2007, and we talked about a little survey we did of that class. And MIDI was high on
It
the
was,
list
yes.
of expectations these guys, have that responsibility in a lot of their church settings. So
Yep.
I think it's real important stuff.
Very good. Let's go on to our ministry resources section. Wanted to call everybody's attention to something that we have talked about in the past. I don't know if it's ever been a pick. Almost everybody, all of our listeners, I think, are familiar with BibleGateway.com. There's another tool out there, another online Bible tool that's gaining some traction. It's probably a little bit more graphically pleasing and maybe a little bit even more flexible because it allows commentary and sharing of notes. There's more of a social nature to this, and that's YouVersion. That's YOUVersion.com. It's something put out by the development team at Life Church. Is it lifechurch.tv? I've got to look
I
that
think
up.
it is.
But they've recently released well, I don't know if it's recent, but they do have an iPod version or iPhone and iPod Touch version. And one of the neat things about that is you can also download certain translations onto the phone or iPod Touch so that you don't always have to be on the internet. But one of the things that I enjoy about it is you can write your own notes and not just write your own notes for your own personal viewing, but you can share that and read what other people have written. So I can see some applications here for Bible study groups.
Absolutely. For me, with the iPod Touch, being able to download a version and not have to be on a wireless network to use the Bible is just an awesome thing. And it's a free application. There are other paid-for applications where you can have the Bible downloaded, but this one is free. You can't download the NIV, however.
For copyright reasons, right?
Exactly. But for free, you can download the New King James, the American Standard, and God's Word. So between those different translations, you ought to be able to find one that is acceptable for your use in an offline Bible study mode.
Yeah,
so I really like that about the iPod version.
And speaking of the NIV, there's some news recently about a new version of it coming out.
A new international version.
The NIV, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, we've got a link to include in our show notes, the press release about that. They're targeting it for 2011, and it was just announced last week. So that will be interesting,
yes. All right, moving on to our picks of the week. Sally, what's your pick this week?
Well, I'm going to stick with
the iPod Touch. I bet it's Google.
Yeah, iPod Touch and Google. Wow, I could go wrong there. But for me, having the iTouch is a really powerful tool. And again, I'm not on an iPhone where I can be connected anytime, anywhere. So I need to be able to download things to my iTouch. And with the Google Sync function, you're able to download your Google Calendar and contacts to your iPod Touch, as well as a BlackBerry, various Nokia phones, and Windows Mobile devices as well. So powerful thing that you can take your calendar offline and your contacts offline. I know, Martin, you said you do this in a different way, not using Google, but by syncing with your Outlook account.
Mm-hmm.
But I just found this to be really useful. And I think I can remember back to when we interviewed Pastor, was it Pastor Calway, about the iPhone when he first got one, an early adopter, one of our really early interviews on the show. And he said being able to have my calendar and contacts with me at any time is very, very valuable to me as I go out and make calls on people and things like that. And so I think this is where we're really unlocking the potential of this this device.
Yep.
For sure.
Yep, absolutely.
So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Basically, on the iPod, you'll need to go to a specific website in the Safari browser application, and then you'll log into your Google account, and it will sync the calendar and contacts with you. From then on, it'll keep you in sync. If you work on the iPod while you're offline, the next time you're back online, it'll sync up to your online account.
Yep. I was not that interested initially in syncing with Google. But there's two reasons that I do so now. On the calendar side, great for calendar sharing with my family. So they know my calendar, I know theirs. We all keep ours updated so that we're in sync. And Google Calendar just seemed to be the best way. Because I use Outlook, they don't. They use other tools. So that was one way to kind of keep everybody on the same page. And for contacts, I really had almost no interest in syncing my contacts to Google because I really never used my Outlook contacts list when I was on Google or Gmail, for instance. It kind of did its own thing. But with the advent and release of Google Voice, it's important to keep your contacts in sync as well because you can create different voicemail messages for different groups. And the only way to get different groups is to obviously keep everything in sync because my primary contact list is in Outlook. So if I want a different greeting for my family versus my business contacts versus church contacts, whatever, that's a great way to do it. And Google Voice does that pretty well. So that's one reason that I found it's necessary to at least give Google a new refreshed sync of my Outlook contacts just so I can use that within Google Voice. So, and it's another backup. So in case something goes horribly wrong, you've got your information there. Does a nice job.
Yeah, I'm just following up then the calendar thing. We do the shared calendaring within our family. We also use Google Calendar for our church and school calendar.
I've seen that.
And I just discovered MVL is using it for Minnesota Valley Lutheran High School has a Google Calendar. So I was able to add that to my Google Calendar and have all the MVL events.
And they can overlay nicely. And, it's a cool view.
Exactly. you start your day by checking out your calendar, and you've got a view of yours, your spouse's, your children, your church, your school, and your high school calendars all
you
in one.
You are informed.
That's pretty powerful. It's actually pretty overwhelming. You might want to back off a little bit.
You can check off the ones you don't need to see or filter the view. Yeah.
That's right.
So cool. All right. My pick of the week is called Backblaze. Not very... not as exciting or thrilling as some of the picks, you know, maybe some wouldn't agree either, as some of the picks I've had in the past. But Backblaze is a backup program, an online cloud-based backup program. We've talked about Carbonite and Mozy in the past. Backblaze is in that same category. I started trying this out last week, so I'm still pretty new. I'll give some updates as I go through the process. But one of the very appealing things about Backblaze is that it works silently in the background. You don't even know it's working. It's just continually, you point it at the files that you want backed up, and it's unlimited. And it'll take any file that you point it at. So I've got a little portable drive that I have for personal things. I've got work things that I can back up as well. I've got about 50 gigabytes of information that that is now on Backblaze. And the price is pretty appealing. It's $5 a month or $50 per year for unlimited use. And what you can do is if you ever need to restore, you can always see what's there. So you can go up on their interface to backblaze.com and see what's backed up. It'll store different versions, up to 4 versions, which is really cool. So if you make some edits to something that you really want to get back, you can go back in time and get up to 4 saves of that information. And then pick the files that you want, and then they'll zip them up and send them back down to you for restore. Or if you've had a major catastrophe, you can get all your files on a DVD for $99 or on a USB drive for $189. So if you had something really go wrong, you could get that in a, and I don't know how long this takes. I can't imagine it would take too long. But you can get all that stuff on a physical, in a physical media back to you rather than emailed back to you via, or made available to you via zip file, and you download the zip file. So far, very impressed. Works on Windows, Mac, 32-bit and 64-bit. I find it very fast. It's obviously going to be limited by your upload speed. So that first backup is going to take a long time. From my home connection, it was backing up, I want to say, about 5 to 10 gigs a day. So if you've got 50 gigs, it's going to take, could take 5, 6, 7 days, something like that. You can back up any file size, which is some of the negatives of some of the other tools that are out there that they have file size limits. And it just works. So I'm really impressed. I'll give you an update once I get through and maybe do some restores over time. But I'm very impressed so far.
And I'm just smiling about that upload speed thing. Sleepy eye comes into play on that one. And I always have big files that it seems to choke up on, you know, the large video files and things like that. Anything I'm trying to get to the internet, I have to be extremely patient. I'll just put it that way.
Yep. And this is something that, I mean, you just let it run. You just leave your computer on. And it once it's up there, then you're good. Then it only updates changes, which is the cool part. So it doesn't do a full backup every month or something like that. It just keeps everything in sync. And, boy, a lot of peace of mind so that you're not having to rely on hard drive backing up to external drive, backing up to DVD. Basically, you've got something off-site, which is always a good idea. Make sure that you've got backups in an off-site location in case there's a fire or some other kind of damage to wherever you're located. So, as more and more of our lives are digital, it's more and more important to doubly back up stuff like this. So,
good to put in place, and then you can kind of forget about it.
That's right.
It's taken care of.
And it's only
check
there
it
when
off
you need
list.
It. That's right.
There you go.
Let's move on to community feedback.
Well, we did hear from a few people this week. First off, we had some comments on our website from David Savatsky. David works in our missions area at the Synod, and he replied to the recent episode we had with the SIM graduates saying that was interesting survey results. And I agree, David. I thought it was really cool to see what these guys were involved in their first 2 years of ministry, and technology-wise at least. And then he had another comment about free storage space. Dropbox is a cross-platform and free and seems to work well.
Yep.
Box.net is great too. So he's got a lot. So it seems like a pretty crowded space there. And I guess you need to decide on one, kind of focus your energies on one of those.
Yeah, when I picked Backblaze for backups, I looked at Dropbox. And I've used Dropbox in the past. It's not as automated, for one, for backups. But if you need to sync files across computers, you know, there's few better than Dropbox. So I would highly recommend that. If you're working on multiple systems and need access to those systems, that's a great way to go as well.
Okay. Next up, we noticed that Pastor Jeremiah Gum had updated our Wells Tech Wiki. And for new listeners, you may not be familiar, but we have a wiki site. It's wellstechwiki.wells.net, where we have just loads of great technology ministry information. And one of the pages there is related to creating a Facebook page for your congregation or school. And he actually added a new Facebook page to the list for his church, which is Cross of Christ in Liverpool, New York. And it's a pretty growing list. You'll want to check that out, maybe see what other people are doing on their Facebook pages and get some ideas there. I actually found and added another one for Wisconsin Lutheran College, now has a Facebook page. So that's on the list as well. And if you have a Facebook page, we'd love it if you would add it to our Wells Tech Wiki as well.
Just want to put in a plug for their website at Cross of Christ. We should include that in their show notes as well in Liverpool, New York. One feature that I like there is they have a visitor's guide. And Pastor Gum has done a great job. And I don't know if he did it or members did it, but they put together a fairly lengthy list of things that a visitor might be interested in knowing. You know, what's the dress code? What's it like to worship there? You know, map, directions, all kinds of stuff. You know, what's the worship? You know, what's this liturgy thing? All kinds of little snippets of information that I think most visitors would want to know. So I would encourage every congregation to think about some kind of informational spot on their site that would be just for visitors, saying, here's the things that you may really be thinking about before you maybe visit here. So great job with that.
And a great idea for a communications committee to consider. So if your congregation doesn't have a communications committee, there's all kinds of directions that they could be pursuing in terms of using the web, particularly to communicate with members and visitors. So put that one on the list for sure.
Beautiful.
And the last comment we had was from David Schumann, who's at Peace in Janesville, Wisconsin. And he had a really interesting comment, Martin. He was surfing the web and a unique situation, and he found that his MP3 files didn't play in the particular web browser that he was using. That web browser was on the Wii. as you know, the Wii can be connected to the internet, and you can surf to websites on the Microsoft Wii gaming station. And what he found was that it did not have a player for MP3s. For instance, when we're in Internet Explorer or Firefox, the MP3s are associated with a playing software like QuickTime or Windows Media Player or whatever it might be, that when it recognizes it's an MP3 file that you're trying to access, it automatically plays using that particular software. That doesn't happen on the Wii. David's observation was, though, that when he went to our Streams website, the MP3s did play because the player is actually built into the website. It's a Flash-based player, I believe, on the Streams website. And so he was wondering how best to program websites so that they're as usable as possible across different browsers on different platforms. And I think, you know, he's kind of stumbled upon a really a challenging question for web developers and cross-platform testing. Maybe not always on the Wii. I don't think that one's as high of usage as some of the other browsers and platforms, you know, Mac versus PC versus Linux boxes or whatever. But it's very hard. It's a big challenge for programmers to develop something that works across all the different possibilities out there.
Yep.
just reminded that it's been in the news lately that Internet Explorer 6 is going to be going away. Microsoft's no longer going to support Internet Explorer 6. And so they're kind of forcing the issue for people that have been avoiding upgrading to Internet Explorer 7 or even Internet Explorer 8 now is available. You know, they're kind of turning off Internet Explorer 6. And so you got to move on, whether you like it or not.
And there's no reason. I can't think of a real reason not to. The upgrade is free. I mean, the original browser was free, so it should not be an issue.
Exactly. So, but, you know, I think David makes a good point in supplying the MP3 files with a player embedded on your site makes them more accessible if the user doesn't have a player already installed for them.
Yeah, we should put the link to that piece of Flash that actually makes that happen, you know, on a website. Flash has its own deal, you know, issues, but I think in cases like this, it does make sense to have essentially your audio files self-contained is kind of how it works, you know, within the site or within the page. You don't have to rely on an external application. The Flash actually plays it. So if you want an example of that, some of you just download this via iTunes and you maybe never go to the show notes page. But if you do go to the show notes page, wellstech.wells.net, you'll see a little play button at the top of each podcast that allows you to play it right there on the page. That's what we're talking about.
Exactly.
All right. Coming up next week, we thought we'd spend some time talking about computer maintenance. Sounds really exciting. But it is important. Fighting malware, registry cleanups, disk defrags, some of the stuff that, just general housekeeping is important to kind of keep that system running. When should you reinstall an operating system we would talk about? You know, do you start from scratch? You know, the new version of Snow Leopard came out. The question would be, you know, do I reformat the drive and put a new copy, lay a new copy down, or do I do an in-place upgrade? That's always the case with Windows. We've got Windows 7 being released. Do you do an upgrade or do you wipe it clean? Is that the best way to go and have to reinstall all your software? How do you keep things running, humming along smoothly? And that's important because the last thing you want to do when you're in the midst of creating a lesson plan or sermon is to have to fight your computer. It should just work. And that's what we're going to talk about next week. Looking forward to that, actually.
I'm thinking if all the techies that are listening are anything like me, they get saddled with that responsibility in a lot of different directions. You know, I've got, a school network to support. I have family and friends that are constantly like, I bet you know what's wrong with my computer and can help me with it. So I think that kind of show is a must show.
Absolutely. And we could probably talk about some remote maintenance tools as well.
Now
that we talk about it. So tune in next week for that. Let's close the show with the music of Michael Schrader, one of our favorite Wells musicians. He's going to sing his song Paradise from the album A Witness. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We will talk to you next week.
Well, I know that you'll be there when the end comes or the beginning of me with you. And I know that you keep me when the end comes, faith in a promise paid by you. In the heart of a moment, in the blink of an eye, the day I'll be with you in paradise. There'll be no more sorrow, there'll be no more pain. Oh, when the end comes, only peace will reign. There'll be no more tears, they'll be wiped away. Oh, when the end comes, only love remains. In the heart of a moment, the blink of an eye. you'll be there when the end comes, or the beginning of me with you. And I know that you'll keep me when the end comes, saved by love and a faith in you. In the heart of a moment, in the blink of an eye,